people that have an organ that opened Live Aid.
Well, hello there, and thanks for downloading this special XXL version of our conversation recorded at Olympic Studios in Barnes in London with Thurston Moore. Olympic Studios, where a good chunk of the records in your collection were possibly recorded, especially, let's say, if your records are actual black vinyl discs and if you like guitars. We're here to meet Thurston Moore, co-founder of the often quite loud avant-punk band Sonic Youth. Moore is having a long and possibly ideal career in music, moving between the alt celebrity of his band and making music at the furthermost limits of the sonic spectrum, while all the time writing about music and running a record label that champions every resistantly underground sound in between. Moore is the Saturday night headliner at this year's New Music Dublin, where his suite, Music for Cloud Formations, has its world premiere. But before that, he spoke to Culture File about hardcore punk and the avant-garde, about the effects on the ear of 50 years standing next to amps, and about the lore of Olympic Studios.
So the guy played for Andy Bowen was the keyboard player for Status Quo. I'm the archivist for the Olympic Studios, Roger Miles. They were first on. They played Rocking All Over the World, and it starts with a piano intro. So he likes to say, these hands started Live Aid. It's great, isn't it? He's donated it to the studio. He lives okay. It was opened in 1966 and closed in 2009, so 43 years. Over 1,000 records were recorded or mixed here. Who's Next? First four Stones albums, first two Led Zeppelin albums, and another three that were mixed here. Joan Armatrading, one of my favourites. The Cure, Wish. But I particularly like Prince did half an album here. He would have done a whole album, but he spent 2 weeks in the kitchen making cupcakes. It's now, 20 years later, very close to reopening as a recording studio on the top floor.
If I wanted to touch one bit of the studio that had been here during any of those recordings, or during the Led Zeppelin recordings, what would I touch?
Well, I think you need to go down to the studio, Screen 1, which is now cinema, going row G, and that's where Jimmy Page would have been playing his guitar on Led Zeppelin 1.
Thurston Moore, I identify myself as a typical dude. Okay. Right now we're sitting in Olympic Studios in SW13, London, and I live nearby. My wife Eva and I live nearby. We moved here a couple of years ago. We used to be in North London for about a decade plus. Bopping around the streets here, I sat in front of this cafe called Olympic Cafe, and I looked up at the building. I said, this is the Olympic Studios, of which I had always heard about, but I had never seen because it was so far away from anywhere I've ever been. And sure enough, it was the studios. It's now a cinema. And so knew nobody in this neighborhood, but soon met the proprietor of the record store across the street, which is the Olympic Studios record store. On display there was a lot of recordings that were done here, you know, Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, Queen, Bowie, U2, Hole, you know, just Buzzcocks, you know, there was so much work that had been done here, including film soundtracks from Get Carter and Bond and everything. A remarkable history from the mid-60s onwards. Before it was Olympic Studios here, it was Olympic Studios in Central London. And then they moved way out here. I talked to John Paul Jones of Led Zeppelin about it, and he said, yeah, when they moved out there to SW13 Barnes, everybody said nobody will go there. It's too far away. But that was not the case. In fact, it was actually very embraced for its remoteness. So Jimi Hendrix loved to come here and get away from the the maddening crowd, and he would rent a small apartment across the street and stay there. And Ronnie Wood, I think his brother or cousin, one of his relatives, outfitted the pub on the corner so people had a place to sort of hang out, do their thing. And musicians would find places to stay, and it was a very comfortable and great-sounding studio. And so all this incredible work was done here.
What's great sound for you in the studio? What makes a great sound?
Well, for me, working in the various studios I've worked in through the years, what constitutes a great sound is certainly the environment of the materials in the studio. And I always found that I liked the resonance of some kind of wood in the studio. And a lot of studios pride themselves in being really isolationist or having this kind of like isolation factor where, you know, sound, there's no sound leakage and seepage, and things can sound either bright or dull, or it's a very controllable environment with like bafflers, you know, for sound. So I like studios that sort of offered a little bit more of a mystery and sound, and less of a real strict controlled environment. So I was never a super big fan of working in, like, you know, really finesse studios. I liked funkier studios. I always appreciated working in studios that had legacies and involved with them. And I never really have too much degree. I never worked in Electric Lady or Abbey Road. But Sonic Youth, we worked at Green Street Studios, which was great, and Magic Shop in New York City, those two studios, which I really liked. The first studio I ever worked in was the Radio City Music Hall studio, where like Toscanini, you know, recorded his orchestras. And that's the first studio experience I had in like the early 80s, recording in Glenn Branca's ensemble. And then after that, it was like a basement. And so for the most of the 80s, it was like, you know, in the basement of somebody's, you know, a building where they had some recording gear. And then we eventually were able to work in a studio such as the Magic Shop or Green Street. I'm not a tech geek, you know. So for me, going to a studio or just like working in with gear, recording gear, etc., is something that never excited me so much. It intrigued me, but if I went to a studio today, I wouldn't know how to do anything except maybe realize how to turn the lights on, you know. So, and I get asked to produce records all the time. It's like, well, that's the aesthetic of producing. I can do. I can sort of sit there, and I know how I think they should sound, and how they should be spread in the field of a stereo spread, and all this. And I have some realization of the discrepancy between microphones and you know, and their placement, and I certainly think I have a very good sensibility for performance. So in that respect, I can see myself in a production place, but as far as the technology of engineering, that's a real incredible learned art form. And when I watch engineers working on analog boards, such as the one they have here now, this Neve board, because they're going to reintroduce Olympic to a new era of recording. I think a lot of producers that I've seen through the years of recording history, I mean, they're basically the guys in the chair, sort of a little bit distant from the board and just listening and communicating. with musicians and the engineer. So what it really is like having a great engineer working with a great producer. And sometimes they're one and the same. But, you know, I think maybe it's better if it's if the producer is really just sort of free.
I'm thinking of Butch Vig, for instance, as a kind of like a super listener in that he was sort of channeling what the world would think of this music, maybe.
Yeah, Butch was very, I mean, my time working with Butch was really, was actually very interesting. I gleaned a lot from what a good producer is through him, because he was very genuine and organic in how he was approaching it. I mean, he started early on with the most minimal of means and equipment, you know, where he was living, and was able to sort of build up a home studio situation that catered to young bands who really didn't have that much money to spend. He was just somebody who really learned his craft. It's the way a photographer will learn their craft, by just studying manuals and being very interested in what they're doing with the technology of a camera. You know, I think about filmmaking a lot, because it's like I have this fantasy of just like making films. It's like, well, you really have to know how to make films. I mean, you can't just like make a film. It's like, oh, well, maybe you can, you know, but you would also need to have, a bottomless credit card, you know, to make a film. So the economics of these things are really sort of the main stopping points for a lot of people.
In some sense, the DIY aesthetic or ethos that maybe, you know, you were a supporter of, is supposed to mitigate against that kind of high craft in a way that, you know, knowledge of the machinery is crucial, and, you know, somehow that will get you to expression.
Well, the sound of spontaneity and immediacy is it's not to be discredited, that's for sure. I mean, I in some ways, I think the bloody-mindedness of doing something in disregard of the money that it takes to do something is really a defining aspect of punk culture, for sure. And it was in some ways a resistant gesture towards like what the music industry had become by the mid-70s. You know, the quote-unquote bloated dinosaur, you know, had to be sort of taken down. It was already stuck in the tar pits anyway.
Yeah. Tell them about it. Hear the way it hurts.
Hey, cool thing. Something I gotta ask you. I just wanna know, what are you gonna do for me? I mean, are you gonna liberate us girls from male, white, corporate oppression?
Tell it like it is.
Huh?
Yeah.
Don't be shy.
Word up.
Fear of a female planet.
Fear. Fear. Planet. Fear, baby.
I just want you to know that we can still be friends.
Let everybody know.
I was very engaged with what was happening in rock and roll music from the mid-60s onward as a little kid. I had an older brother who was 5 years older, so he had all of that coming into our household as well. And of course, all your contemporaries and peers and school are all sharing this knowledge. And that was the golden knowledge of anybody coming up in the 60s and 70s was rock and roll, soul and R&B and everything that was happening on the radio. And I was super, super attracted to that. There was music in our house all the time anyway. You know, my father was a musician, and so music was sort of was commonplace in our house. I didn't realize until later on in my years that it wasn't very commonplace in most people's houses. And I was like, well, where's the music? Where's the piano? Where's the record player? Where's the art on the walls? Where, you know, it's just like, oh, so we're kind of odd ducks here, you know, because there's culture. Because every other aspect of my life was not that. It's just being sort of a middle class white kid in rural USA, you know. I didn't react to it like, oh, I want to be like everybody else. I don't want this. I actually sort of, I found it actually really, really enriching at a young age. And I realized, without being able to articulate the realization, that it was valuable and it was nourishing. And I knew that that's what my life would become. And that's what my vocation would be something to do with literature or music or, you know, whatever. But I also realized that I was a bit resistant to authority to a degree where I wasn't going to really do the work. I wanted to do it, and I really wanted the immediacy of doing something. And I was just like, well, how am I going to write songs and make a record or play guitar without having the expertise that is associated with it, such as Eric Clapton or Jimmy Page or, you know, Jimi Hendrix, for God's sakes, or even that kind of vision. I felt like I had the vision, but I just, you know, it's just like to attain that technique. I felt like I don't have time to attain the technique. I know I need to do this immediately. And then when being at 16, 17, 18 years old, when you start seeing and hearing, you know, Patti Smith Group, or even before I had that, the Stooges, hearing the Stooges for the first time was just like, oh, wait, they're playing 2-3 chords. There's something going on here that's just like kind of amazing, and nobody likes it. I mean, I would get that first Stooges record and play it, and it was like people would just like take that off, please. I can still remember hearing it for the first time, thinking like how minimal and strange that was, you know. But knowing that that group, those musicians, were very they had such conviction. But it stood so alone. And then just when you first hear the Ramones. '76, I guess, is when I first would hear the first Ramones album. And thinking like, oh, they're also responding to that in a way. And they're also just like, they're playing from the ground up. They're playing bar chords, like 3 or 4 of them, and creating this amazing document of, you know, and it's like it was really sort of almost high art in a way. They're all dressed the same, they all have the same last name, and all the songs sound the same. And so it's just like, wow. And there's no lead guitar. Like, you know, who would have dared have that audacity to make a record where there's no lead guitar? It was brilliant. My two dogs, Vinkanog and Apollo, have just entered into the conversation. So if you hear some, that's not exactly, it's not always me. It could be one of these two dogs. And my wife, Eva, is here as well. They were taking a walk. I think my perception was, well, first of all, I mean, the first Ramones album, unlike any of their other albums subsequently, was the only one that was so defined by its minimalism, where the guitar, Johnny's guitar is in one speaker and Dee Dee's bass is in the other speaker. And that decision is to this day like so radical. And you very rarely come across a recording like that. It was just like, it was such a remarkable gesture. And it's like, yeah, of course, why not? You put the one guitar here, one guitar there, and it's just like, and don't touch the controls. Just like let it be raw and direct.
You burn to the ounce, makes us want to pounce. You just be totally perfect. American, you said you were tired.
That directness, it was, would always be something that I aspired to, even when Sonic Youth got more involved with, I think, more elaborate composition. And when that wasn't there, I would become a bit anxious. When Jim O'Rourke joined the band, and he was somebody who was really working in the capacity as a sophisticated engineer, and then he was also in the band playing bass guitar and some synth. But he was behind the mixing console for the records that he was involved with while he was in the band. And there was one song that we recorded really quickly that was called like Arthur Doyle and the Hand Cream or something like that. I think that's what it was called. It was a silly title. But it was like a really fast sort of garage rock kind of thing, and with these lyrics that we all actually sort of wrote together, which was unusual, and one of the only times we ever did that in studio. We had our own studio in New York on Murray Street Studios. And I remember there was a bit difficulty in mixing that song. It always sounded a little sort of just too controlled and flat. And I asked Jim, I said, Jim, I think it needs to sound more like a garage rock record. Like you should listen to the Cramps or something. And he looked at me and he said, I don't know that. Like, that's not my thing. Like, I didn't come up listening to the Cramps and garage rock and stuff. I came up listening to Rush and Genesis. And then, you know, these other kind of like refined kind of examples in punk rock and new wave. But as far as that kind of rough-hewn kind of like garage punk thing, that was not his thing. And so I said, well, let me try my hand at it, you know, and I just sort of like moved a few faders up and I took some of the compression off and blah, 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 blah. And it was just sort of, and the song just sort of like all of a sudden woke up to what it was supposed to be. For me, it's like, that's an aspect that I think was always essential to certainly what I was doing, but in the context of Sonic Youth as well. I mean, being in a car with some family and Pink Floyd comes on the radio and my older sister says, this is what your band should sound like. This is what you should do. Or one of the A&R men at Geffen Records saying, like, we really see you becoming like the punk rock Pink Floyd, you know. It's like, that was sort of the wish for Sonic Youth. Like, can you do that? And I thought, like, well, we probably very well could if we set our minds to it, and we could, and maybe capitalize on doing such a thing. And God forbid we would have become like Radiohead or something. I don't know, but it's but there was always this element of just recklessness that I really found in punk rock music that I didn't want to completely dispel. And so certainly, like you were mentioning earlier, feedback and noise were elemental to that. You know, it was offering something in the music that was fairly antagonistic, maybe sonically, but at the same time was in regards to like action painting, an ugly beauty. And I get really, of course, to this day, engaged in like what noise music can be.
There's often, and that has been particularly, say, from the 70s onwards, this pantomime that musical acts get involved in, which is, you know, they start in a very vital kind of community and scene, and then they, you know, that scene spreads and more people are interested and it seems like a commercial proposition. And obviously they have to decide whether to go down that road or not, or whether there is anything they will lose that's really valuable. And maybe more than any other band, Sonic Youth really engaged with that and attempted to not remove those things or not leave behind totally those things that, that were in their scene, their community. It's an ongoing fight.
Yeah, definitely. We were always an art rock band, pure and simple. Even though I had conflict with that early on, you know, when I was so enamored by like the purism of like hardcore, like it was particularly North American hardcore punk rock, you know, this idea of just like being very pure in your intention with like, you know, the single instrument, the single idea of like what a song structure is and what the, and these emotions that are sort of laid bare in the lyrics. And then what we were doing was more sort of fragrant or something. And I remember walking down the street in New York in the early 80s, and we had a bunch of guitars with us, and we were going to play our gig at the Pyramid Club. Some punk kids, hardcore punk kids, were sitting on a stoop, and as we walked by, one of them went, "Artsy bands rule." And I, you know, as a bit of a devaluation of who we were. And I felt like kind of, oh man, you know, like we're kind of like, you know, we're not pure, you know, we're like, we're too flowery or something. But then it was interesting, you know, by this time Nirvana became commodified so much in the music industry, where you saw this kind of embrace of experimentalism, because that could not be commodified very easily. And so you saw a lot of people who had the aesthetic of punk rock who embraced what was happening in the late 80s with bands like Nirvana. And Kurt kills himself at the apex of all this. All of a sudden you saw this real turn towards the underground embracing avant-garde and art rock and experimental music to a huge degree, and noise music. And the Sonic Youth became very emblematic of that as a band that existed all through the 80s as the poster band for, you know, all of this activity for this new generation. And meeting young people, starting bands like Pavement and Steve Malkmus, like, yeah, we were the kids in the front at the club in Richmond, Virginia, when we were going to school there. And we went to every Sonic Youth and SST label, you know, group. You know, that's who we were, and that's what made us make bands. So that was kind of, for me, was like somewhat interesting kind of accolade and payoff, you know, from having this conflicted feeling all through the 80s that maybe we were too, you know, unusual for the sake of being unusual in what we were doing. Have Spotify. I never will have Spotify. I never utilize Spotify. I've attempted to get my music off Spotify, but the argument is like, well, it'll always exist there. Even if you officially take it down, it will always be available through some, you know, through some channel through Spotify and all these Spotify playlists that are created by you. I've never created a playlist in my life for Spotify, even though my name says I have a playlist. It's just sort of It listens and reads interviews by artists and hears what they're talking about with the music and the songs, et cetera, and it creates its own playlist. I refuse to acknowledge or support the S word.
Well, that makes sense, of course, in a way, because of your interest in the kind of tactile qualities of the media, that you've spoken a lot about records and all that, this idea that, yes, you know, there's something that people sort of fetishize about sound, but actually there's something transmitted in the object itself. And the same maybe with chapbooks, that the objects themselves are quite important.
I mean, you can't touch a stream. I mean, you certainly can't look at it. I mean, you can look at the information on the, you know, on whatever your device is. I don't begrudge it you know, for its ability to sort of create exchanges of information, whether the information is music or literature or visual art. But it's in complete defiance of all the other senses. You know, you can't smell it. You can't taste it. You certainly can't touch it. So the vibrational aspects of what I like about music and art are devoid in digital streaming. Records are so weird to me because to this day, to me, the invention of the phonograph by Edison or whatever, of like a stylus picking up information from like grooves on a round disc or early on, like on a cylinder. And then, I mean, that development into what became like, you know, the industry of records seems really happenstance to me in a way. Like that's just how that one inventor kind of went for a duplicating sound. You know, it could it have gone any other way? Could have been some other way of doing it? I mean, I don't know. But the fact that it went towards this kind of electromagnetic stylus picking up vibrations from a from these grooves in this like black vinyl. I mean, it's just like it's such a great contemporary, almost sci-fi kind of like thing. There's something very amusingly absurd about like, you know, music in the physicality of music. Tapes, you know, the idea that you can create like sound that can be duplicated on a magnetic tape that goes over a magnetic tape head, you know, I mean, this whole thing. So when digital came in where it was like laser reading information, that made a little more sense to me. But the physical technology of music is still to me like mind-boggling. And I'm a great lover of obsolete units, of obsolete devices, you know, of old recorders and what have you, and what sounds they make. We don't really necessitate progress in music technology. In fact, a lot of what was accomplished in analog recording has just like been thrown in the bin. You know, I mean, when you listen to say something like Spotify, you're listening to like a very diminished frequency range of music. It's like worse than the 1910 acetate. You know, I mean, it's just like we just like got rid of all of this developed expertise that happened all through the 50s and 60s with these recording engineers who just like really, really made such incredible recordings. You know, when you hear like an analog recording of say like John Coltrane Impulse album or something. I mean, listen to that on a Spotify stream. It's just like, it's a crime. I think Daniel Ek should be put away for life. With analog, it's you know, visually it's a bit of a curved line of information, and you're each time you listen to it, it kind of it imparts the information differently each time you listen to it. So when, as a young child, I remember playing records over and over again, and they would always sound new and different each time, and a lot of that had to do with even like the degradation of the recording being played too many times. It's like, you know, so you have an artist like Christian Marclay actually making an art record called Record Without a Cover, where he made a record without a cover with whatever sound he had put on it, and he outlined the entire gallery floor with this album. So when people would come in, they'd be walking on the records, and then he pulled them all up and he disseminated this record. And so anybody who got a copy of that record, each record was different, and each one was kind of, you know, its own sound world. In digital, it's numerical, and so your ear always hears the same thing, and so it doesn't really find anything new the second time around. In fact, it's already pretty much exhausted by what it's heard, you know. Whereas with analog, it's always curious. So that curiosity is a factor that is missing in that move. And I find that to be slightly esoteric, and I do kind of also find that there is some truth to it. I do find that there is definitely an ear massage going on with analog recordings. But, you know, I was listening to Goat's Head Soup by the Rolling Stones the other day.
Recorded here, by any chance?
I think it was recorded here. And I had found an original UK pressing of that record somewhere in some record bin. And I had I bought it because it was like a beautiful looking record. And I had it as a kid anyway, but I had like the US version. I always kind of liked that record because it was kind of like this slightly sloppy kind of Rolling Stones record that people couldn't really get a hold on at first. But it was this transitional time during the Stones and what was going on in the world at the time. And so it's a curious record, and I like it. And I kind of wanted to listen to it. It's been some time, and it sounded terrible to me. I put the record on, and it was like it was dull, and I was like, well, how I can't, you know, Jagger's vocals were really kind of like muted, and I figured, well, if I turn the, I have a pretty decent stereo, and I would turn it up, and it sounded better the louder it got, but it still sounded kind of compromised, and I had something to do with like. Well, this record's been around since like the early 70s, and it's probably been played a lot. And it's just sort of like there has been some degradation going on here. And I bet if I buy a remastered CD of Goat's Head Soup, it'll sound fantastic, you know, and then I'll really be able to hear all these aspects of what that recording was, more so than this piece of vinyl. And so I realized that there has been improvements in a lot of recordings, more or less. I mean, you know, Jimmy Page remastered a lot of the Led Zeppelin stuff, but kind of in a polarizing way. A lot of people are like, no, I prefer that first pressing vinyl. I think unless you really have some great, you know, sophisticated equalizer in your house, it doesn't really make any sense anyway. In fact, I'm kind of defiant against audio technology to the extent where I just give me a cassette that I buy at a petrol station of T-Rex before anything, and I'll just listen to that. I sort of like the economics of that anyway. It's like I'm conflicted about record collecting too. It's just like because records have become so expensive in the collector's market. And I find like, oh, that kind of changes the game. It's a little embarrassing if somebody comes over and like, how much did you pay for that Sun Ra album? You don't want to say like, oh, that was like, you know, 800 quid. You don't want to say like, oh, I found it for 80 pence in a charity shop. You know, I don't want anybody to think I paid 800 quid for a Sun Ra record. And on the record, I never have done that. But I, so I'm very concerned about like, you know, I'm not going to do that. Like, I'm not going to, like, have these kind of, these gold nuggets in my collection. I'm kind of more into, like, the searching for, like, the affordable copy of this record. Look what I got for, like, 3 quid. You know, this is, like, a 300 quid record. That, to me, is what I enjoy, as opposed to, like, sneaking it home as, like, you know,
dirty little secret.
filing it away, and it's like, that's too lonely. I can't do that.
You mentioned there that after you've listened to a digital recording, maybe your ear has kind of explored it fully because it's not going to change. But one of the things that over the course of your career, and particularly in the music you work in, that changes is you and physiologically how you are understanding the music and indeed the function of your ear. So I'm wondering, like, for somebody who for, you know, many years has worked with noise and, you know, have been interested in the effects of volume, its power, and also its kind of sculptural effects, how that leaves your body and your sensorium.
Yeah, I'm very interested in the physiology of music in a room. I mean, bands like Swans or Sun-O, you know, where they really, really attempt to activate a room with the output of volume, where volume becomes an element in the music, whether it's improvisation or composition. Yeah, that's always been interesting. When I was working with Glenn Branca in the early 80s, that was always very elemental to him in his composition, where at a certain volume, the frequencies transmorph into other things. And so there's what he called resultant harmonies coming out of harmonies, which makes sense. I mean, of course, that's what happens, and you start hearing these other layers happening because it's so loud. But for me, it's just like, at 66 years old, I mean, I have audio processing issues. I have tinnitus, you know, not some place where it's so so utterly terrifying, but I do have it, you know, and it affects a lot of my listening to like films, you know, and like because I can hear it, but I can't really decipher a lot of the dialogue sometimes, and it has something to do with that kind of mollification that happens in my hearing. It has something to do with age, but it also has something to do with standing in front of an amplifier and playing it at a certain volume. And Sonic Youth were always considered like a loud band, but I never thought we were as loud as, say, you know, a band like Led Zeppelin or Black Sabbath or what have you. I mean, they were loud bands. Going to see punk rock gigs where it's Ramones or Dictators or Dead Boys or whatever, Clash. I mean, they were loud bands. I mean, you know, and so I never thought like Sonic Youth was any louder. I mean, you know, but I think what we were presenting, which was this usage of guitar feedback, it's a different loudness. I mean, it's just like, so when you have sort of high frequency feedback coming from a guitar amp, you think that it's unusually loud, but it's really not that much louder than, you know, cymbal splash, you know, sometimes. In fact, the cymbal splash sometimes overrides what you're doing with the feedback in the guitar. I never was really interested in loudness being a some kind of thrill for the audience. Like, I never wanted to like blow the audience's head off with those. I wanted the audience to hear the intention of the improvisation of feedback that we would that either Lee and I or Lee Kim and I, when it got to that point, or Lee Kim, Jim O'Rourke and I, as a quartet playing guitar feedback improvisations within a certain composition that we would have, which got more and more prevalent as we got into the 90s and to the 2000s, where we actually were really thinking about these aspects of improvisation, you know, and how that interplay, and that really became more interesting of how to use feedback. And to this day, when I play improvised guitar music with a percussionist or another player, whether it's a reeds player or whatever, even though I've been doing duos with John Paul Jones of Led Zeppelin, it's very hardcore feedback improvisations. I use a lot of different feedback and noise making with the guitar. You know, much to the polarization of the listeners and the audience who want to hear A Whole Lot of Love and Teenage Riot, they're hearing neither, you know. I mean, because John is really interested in creating these kind of sound worlds made of noise sources, you know, either digitally or from his bass going through different effects. And that's what we do decidedly. You know, so there's absolutely no musical composition happening. It's all improvisational noise action.
And in a way, that can happen at any volume. And I wonder, as you get older, do you think, well, I can do all these effects, but, you know, it's more lean in. I'm not going to shove it out there so much.
Very much so. I mean, It's funny because when I first moved to London, I got involved with like the improvisation scene here, and people that I had always admired through the years, and people slightly older than me, are practitioners of free improvisation, whether it's Evan Parker or John Russell, who's no longer with us. And Derek, I had played with a couple of times in New York, but by the time I moved to London, he was no longer alive. You know, and a lot of contemporary players on the scene, Steve Noble and John Edwards and Alan Wilkinson. And at first, you know, when I would begin playing with these players, it was this idea that like, oh, we have to play loud because I came out of Sonic Youth. I come out of this, you know, I'm a loud guitar, noisy guy. And so that's where we're going to go with this. Whereas my desire was like, no, I really want to get into a more sort of plaintive and quiet world with what I hear in a lot of the history of a British free improvisation. That's what I want to investigate. And so it was a bit of a loggerheads thing where it's like they were like, oh, yeah, we're going to do some loud music now. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to do some quiet music now. And I've run into that so many times. And I did a tour of Italy with these two Italian improvisers who were very well known in the Italy free improvisation scene. And I was really looking forward to doing this trio where I could play like this more sitting in a chair and like listening to each other as a trio and playing this more sort of classical free improvisation. And they were all about like, no, let's blow it out. And they were booking gigs at like rock clubs that started at 12 a.m., you know, as opposed to me wanting to play at like 6 p.m. for like the people sitting in chairs and with their and scratching their chins. That's what I wanted. So there was like this, there was this little bit of a conflict there. But, you know, I soon sort of, and I would discuss this with them as well. I was like, I kind of want to play quiet. Oh, come on. Mats Gustafsson, the Swedish saxophone player, who's known for playing very, like, hardcore free improvisation saxophone, and we would play together in duos sometimes. We were around the same age. I'm a little older than he is. And they would be very high-powered, kind of feedback guitar noise. He would go over to a tabletop and play like a lot of jerry-rigged noise music on the tabletop as well as his saxophone. And we would just do these kind of gigs where they were very muscular and blown out. And at some point, I told him, I said, there's at times when we're playing where we actually come way down and you're just using the mouthpiece and I'm just barely touching the strings and we're kind of getting into this world. And why don't we just do an entire set of that kind of music playing? In fact, why don't we go on tour and do a whole tour and let's call it The New Quiet. And he was completely signed on to this. He was like, yes, yes, I really want to do that too. So we booked a whole tour around Europe called The New Quiet. And we had plane tickets, the gigs were booked, and all of a sudden, there was a plague around the earth called COVID, and everything was canceled. So we never returned to it. It was very quiet, it got very quiet. It was beyond our expectations.
The piece that you're bringing to Dublin, which is guitar explorations of cloud formations, I wonder how that fits in your kind of sliding scale of loud, quiet.
It's right in there. I mean, for me, the idea of being contemplative of the natural world in creating composition, yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, it's this full dynamic range of what, you know, constitutes the volume of our existence and of, you know, crushing noise to the footsteps of an insect. So for me, I mean, both my wife Eva and I devised this idea of guitar compositions for Cloud Formations. It's just sort of in consideration to just the intrigue and inspiration and influence of the natural world, where that's such, to me, it's always about being contemplative of nature. And that's something that's always, for me, has been a consideration since I was very young. I used to always think about, like, that as a... the great attainment is to sort of create art that is reflective of the natural world, because that's the true art of creation. I always, like, you know, I remember being very young and coming to this kind of conclusion, like, you know, there's no art greater than God's art, which is sort of like Cloud Formations. The majesty of trees, you know, it's like just the mysterious power of and energy of water, bodies of water. I mean, when you come across these texts about people who meditate around bodies of polluted lakes, and the lakes change into they detoxify through the meditation of people. And I was just like, that's curious. I'd like to actually see that firsthand, which I haven't. But I'm not going to disbelieve what I'm reading here. And you know, I realize there's a lot of esoterica involved in sort of like in creating music and art in relation to the otherworldliness of the world. And so it's just the power of poetry and creating a line of poetry, creating a title, guitar, guitar compositions that are kind of based on Cloud Formations. It's just like, but it allows investigation into that, you know, and it allows that for us to actually really investigate that and see how that inspires the sound world that will be created. Because in some ways, it's all very abstract. I mean, you basically need a device to create composition, and sometimes it's just your own imagination.
Well, I wondered how abstract it was, because when I've read what you've been saying about the piece, it feels like that there's a strong visual component and some way of reaching a kind of visual... a form of your music, or taking a visual aspect and bringing it into feedback and into exploratory improvisational music. Like, how important is that visual element in the way you're working now?
I think it's always been important to the music that certainly Sonic Youth created. We were always, the band was comprised of at least two visual artists who were practicing visual artists, both Leah and Kim. I came out of a household where visual art was really essential, and so the idea of the relationship between the music and the visual was always a big part of the band. We always had some kind of visual aspect to what was going on stage with us.
I'm not sure. Does this sound pejorative? It's not meant to be pejorative. That had to do with maybe creating a big world for the band and how it looked. So there was how it looked and the way album covers looked, and photography was a certain way, but that it wasn't necessarily a representation of the music. You know, and maybe now there's a closer analogy between visual work and the sound.
You're right. I mean, you're right to some extent. I mean, this right, something like creating composition in relation to like cloud formation and all that. It's a dialogue. It's an exchange, and one thing informs the other. And you're right about creating a backdrop for like a Sonic Youth performance. It's not really like that backdrop is informing the music. The music was already there, you know. And so it's basically a complement to the music that preexisted. Whereas this is something where the music is being formulated in this kind of dialogue with like cloud study, you know, and without it becoming sort of like hippy dippy, like, oh, you're writing music for clouds. You know, there's like three wars going on in the world right now, and you're writing music for clouds. It's like, well, I mean, what do clouds represent to the human condition anyway? I mean, it's just like you talk, clouds are like the foretelling of storms. And if there's any kind of like foretelling of storms right now, we're already in the midst of a great storm brewing on the human front anyway. So it's just like there's a lot of allegory that I find in talking about clouds and what clouds mean to the emotional landscape of the world. I spent a lot of time in southern Florida, which is where I was born. And it's just like, for me, it's a big part of your daily life. It's like these huge storming clouds that sort of just like drop, you know, like 30 minutes of just like torrential rain on the populace, and then it just disappears. And living here in the British Isles, it's like the low-lying cloud world is like really it's really interesting to me how that affects the psychology of the society.
How does it?
Well, I think it makes it far less complacent than I find in societies that have more sort of static environments, you know, in the natural world. There's a higher state of emotional anxiety in England and just about any other country. It's really curious. I'm always guarded emotionally, you know, so it's just like, it's like a little frightening for me. I'm very, very afraid of conflict all the time. And so it's really good for me. I think it's, you know, I always see things as being somewhat something to do with destiny, but I always find relocating to UK 12 years ago was really just I felt there was some kind of reason for it personally. You know, if somebody told me 30 years ago that I would be living here, I would have said, you're crazy. That's absolutely not going to happen.
When you look out that window there now and there's nothing but that very, very, very pale blue-gray cloud just sitting on top of us, which it has for the last couple of weeks, and it'll continue. Is that a good feeling?
Yeah, well, I realize it's February, and I also realize that on the other side of that heavy cloud set is a sun. There is a star up there. There is a sun. It will be there when those clouds part, you know, come springtime. And so I always realize that it is up there. And I also know that the clouds hold nutrients that clean our air, our space. And this is all currency for our lives. I mean, right now, I mean, we're seeing this cabal of ownership for the natural world. Water is going to become a great currency in the future probably after we're all gone. But things are happening at such a rapid pace right now. But yeah, that's whoever owns water, whoever owns air is going to be like the great. and that's sort of what's going on here. I mean, it's all about real estate. I mean, Donald Trump is nothing but like, you know, a real estate mogul who's kind of allowing him and his people to sort of continue to take over the so-called free world. You know, it's all about ownership.
Did you see Youth Against Fascism kind of popping up the Spotify charts again?
Yeah. I mean, it's a great title. I sort of got the title from just a headline somewhere in like some liberal newspaper way back in the day, and it said Youth Against Fascism. I said that's a great title for a song, and it was right when the Gulf War was happening, and so I penned these lyrics, and I was thinking about these friends of mine or these associates of mine who were in bands in the Washington, D.C. area, standing outside of the George Bush White House at the time. And they were doing a noise protest where they're banging on pots and pans, and just like that was like their noise protest. And so I equated that with like Youth Against Fascism and sort of wrote these lyrics. But yeah, the phrase "Youth Against Fascism" is always good. I think those lyrics I wrote, I wish I could have, I wish I could go back in time and sort of rewrite them a little bit, because they're purposefully sort of like sort of snot-nosed in a way. But, you know, I wrote them really quickly, and it, you know, it was just like, and it was, and I remember writing, I wrote that riff thinking I was writing, I was pretending I was a bass player in The Fall. And that's what I would have written if I was a bass player in The Fall. And that's what that song is based on.
You know, that'd be a great encore to Cloud Formation.
Maybe, yeah, I might have to bust that one out. I can rewrite the lyrics a little bit. Yeah, that's a good idea. I'll give you some credit on that one. Let me get the libretto together. It's the song I hate. It's the song I
hate. It's the song I hate. Thurston Moore there at Olympic Studios in Barnes in London. Suite for Cloud Formations is on at the National Concert Hall in Dublin as part of New Music Dublin on Saturday, the 5th of April.